Part 2 Chapter 1 2 days after the strange incident at Nastasia Filipovna's party, with which we concluded the first part of our story, Prince Mushkin was hurrying on his way to Moscow to receive his unexpected fortune. It was said that there might be other reasons for his hasty departure, but of this, and of Mushkin's adventures during his absence from Petersburg, we can give little information. Mushkin was away just 6 months, and even those who had reason to be interested in his fate could find out very little at that time. Though rumours did reach them indeed at rare intervals, they were for the most part strange ones, and almost always contradictory. The Epanchin family, of course, took more interest in Mushkin than anyone else, though he went away without even taking leave of them. General Epanchin did see him 2 or 3 times. They had some serious conversation. But though the general saw him, he did not mention it to his family. And indeed, at first, for almost a month after Mushkin had gone, his name was avoided by the Epanchins altogether. Only Madame Epanchin had pronounced at the very beginning that she had been cruelly mistaken in the prince. Then, 2 or 3 days later, she added vaguely, not mentioning Mushkin's name, that the most striking thing in her life was the way she was continually being mistaken in people. And finally, 10 days later, she wound up by adding sententiously that she was vexed with her daughters. "We have made mistakes enough. We'll have no more of them." We must add that for some time there was rather an unpleasant feeling in the house. There was a sense of oppression, of strain, of some unspoken dissension. Everyone wore a frown. The general was busy day and night, absorbed in his work. His household hardly got a glimpse of him. He had rarely been seen more active and occupied, especially in his official work. As for the young ladies, no word was spoken by them openly. Perhaps even when they were alone together, very little was said. They were proud, haughty girls, and reserved even with one another, though they understood each other, not only at a word but at a glance, so that sometimes there was no need to say much. There was only one conclusion that might have been drawn by a disinterested observer, if there had happened to be such a one, namely, that to judge from the above-mentioned facts, few as they were, Mushkin had succeeded in making a marked impression on the Epanchin family, though he had only been once among them, and then for a short time. Perhaps the feeling he had inspired was simply curiosity, aroused by certain eccentric adventures of Mushkin's. However that might be, the impression remained. Little by little, the rumours that had circulated about the town were lost in the darkness of uncertainty. A story was told indeed of some little prince who was a simpleton, no one could be sure of his name, who had suddenly come into a vast fortune and married a Frenchwoman, a notorious dancer of the can-can from the Chateau de Fleurs in Paris. But others declared that it was a general who had come in for a fortune, and that the man who had married the notorious French can-can dancer was a young Russian merchant of untold wealth, and that at his wedding, from pure bravado, he had, when drunk, burnt in a candle lottery tickets to the value of 700,000 rubles. But all these rumours soon died away, a result to which circumstances greatly contributed. All Rogozhin's followers, for instance, many of whom might have had something to say, had all gone in his wake to Moscow, a week after an awful orgy at the Ekaterinhof Vauxhall, in which Nastasia Filipovna took part. The few persons who were interested in the subject learnt from certain reports that Nastasia Filipovna had run off and disappeared the day after this orgy, and she seems to have been traced to Moscow, so that Rogozhin's departure to Moscow seemed to fall in with this rumour. There were rumours, too, with regard to Gavril Ardialonovich Ivolgin, who was also pretty well known in his own circle. But something happened to him which quickly softened, and in the end completely stopped all unpleasant stories about him. He fell seriously ill, and unable to go to his office, much less into society. He recovered after a month's illness, but for some reason resigned his position in the office of the joint stock company and was replaced by another man. He had not once been to the Epanchin's house, either, so another clerk undertook the duties of secretary to the general. Gavriil Ardalionovitch's enemies might have assumed that he was so crestfallen at all that had happened to him as to be ashamed to go out into the street. But he was really ill, and sank into a state of hypochondria. He grew moody and irritable. Varvara Ardalionovna was married to Titsin that winter. All who knew them put the marriage down to the fact that Ganya was unwilling to return to his duties, and was not only unable to keep his family, but was even in need of assistance, and almost of care himself. It may be observed, in parenthesis, that no mention was made in the Epanchin family of Gavriil Ardalionovitch either, as though such a man had never been seen in their house, nor had indeed existed in the world at all. Yet meantime, everyone in the family learnt, and very shortly indeed, one remarkable fact concerning him. On the fatal night after his unpleasant experience with Nastasia Philipovna, Ganya did not go to bed on returning home, but awaited Mushkin's return with feverish impatience. Mushkin, who had gone to Ekaterinhof, came home at 6 o'clock next morning. Then Ganya went into his room and laid on the table before him the roll of scorched notes presented to him by Nastasia Philipovna while he lay fainting. He begged Mushkin to give his present back to her at the first opportunity. When Ganya went into Mushkin's room, he was in a hostile and almost desperate mood. But some words must have been exchanged between them, after which Ganya stayed 2 hours with Mushkin, sobbing bitterly all the time. They parted on affectionate terms. This story, which reached the Epanchins, turned out to be perfectly correct. It was strange, of course, that such facts could so soon come out and be generally known. All that had happened at Nastasia Philipovna's, for instance, became known at the Epanchins almost the next day, and fairly accurately. As for the facts concerning Gavriil Ardalionovitch, it might have been supposed that they had been carried to the Epanchins by Varvara Ardalionovna, who suddenly became a frequent visitor and an intimate friend of the girls, to the great astonishment of Lizaveta Prokofievna. But though Varvara Ardalionovna thought fit for some reason to make such friends with the Epanchins, yet she certainly would not have talked to them about her brother. She too was rather a proud woman in her own way, although she did seek the intimacy of people who had almost turned her brother out. She had been acquainted with the Epanchin girls before, but she had seen them rarely. She hardly ever showed herself in the drawing-room, even now, however, and went in, or rather slipped in, by the back staircase. Lizaveta Prokofievna had never cared for her, and did not care for her now, though she had a great respect for her mother, Nina Alexandrovna. She wondered, was angry, and put down their intimacy with Varya to the whims and self-will of her daughters, who did not know what to think of to oppose her. But Varya continued to visit them, both before and after her marriage. A month after Mushkin's departure, however, Madame Epanchin received a letter from old Princess Bielokonski, who had gone a fortnight before to Moscow to stay with her eldest married daughter, and this letter had a marked effect upon her, though she said nothing of it to her daughters or to Ivan Fyodorovitch, but from various signs it was evident to them that she was much excited, even agitated by it. She began talking rather strangely to her daughters, and always of such extraordinary subjects. She was evidently longing to open her heart, but for some reason restrained herself. She was affectionate to everyone on the day she received the letter. She even kissed Adelaida and Aglaia. She owned herself in fault in regard to them, but they could not make out how. She even became indulgent to Ivan Fyodorovitch, who had been in her bad books for the past month. Next day, of course, she was extremely angry at her own sentimentality, and managed to quarrel with everyone before dinner. But the horizon cleared again towards the evening. For a whole week she continued to be in a fairly good humour, which had not been the case for a long time past. But a week later a second letter came from Princess Bielokonski, and this time Madame Epanchin made up her mind to speak out. She announced solemnly that old Bielokonski— she never called the princess anything else when she spoke of her behind her back, gave her comforting news about that queer fellow, that prince, you know. The old lady had traced him in Moscow, had inquired about him, and had found out something very good. Mushkin had been to see her himself at last, and had made an extremely good impression on her, as was evident from the fact that she invited him to come and see her every afternoon between 1 and 2.
"He has been hanging about there every day, and she is not sick of him yet,"
Madame Epanchin concluded, adding that, through the old woman, the prince had been received in 2 or 3 good families.
"It's a good thing that he doesn't stick at home and isn't shy like a noodle."
The girls to whom all this was imparted noticed at once that their mamma was concealing a great deal in the letter. Perhaps they learnt this from Varvara Ardalionovna, who might and probably did know everything Titsin knew about Mushkin and his stay in Moscow. And Titsin was in a position to know more than anyone else. But he was an exceedingly silent man in regard to business matters, though, of course, he used to talk to Varya. Madame Epanchin conceived a greater dislike than ever for Varya on account of it. But anyway, the ice was broken, and it became suddenly possible to speak of Mushkin aloud. Moreover, the great interest he had awakened and the extraordinary impression he had left on the Epanchins were once more apparent. The mother was astonished, indeed, at the effect that her news from Moscow had on her daughters, and the daughters, too, wondered at their mamma, who, after declaring that the most striking thing in her life was the way she was continually being mistaken in people, had yet procured for the prince the protection of the powerful old Princess Bielokonski, though it must have cost her much begging and praying, for the old woman was difficult to prevail upon in such cases. But as soon as the ice was broken, and there was a change in the wind, the general, too, hastened to express himself. It appeared that he, too, had been taking an exceptional interest in Mushkin, but he discussed only the business aspect of the question. It appeared that in the interests of the prince, he had asked 2 very trustworthy, and in their own way influential persons in Moscow, to keep an eye on him, and still more on Salazkin, who had the charge of his affairs. All that had been said about the fortune, about the fact of the fortune, that is to say, had turned out to be true, but the fortune itself had turned out to be much less considerable than had been rumoured at first. The property was partly in an involved condition. There were, it appeared, debts. Other claimants turned up too, and in spite of the advice given him, Mushkin had behaved in a most unbusinesslike way.
"God bless him, of course."
Now, when the ice of silence was broken, the general was glad to express his feelings.
"In all sincerity of heart."
For though
the fellow was a bit lacking,
still he did deserve it. Yet he had done something stupid. Creditors of the late merchants had sent in claims, for instance, based on questionable or worthless documents, and some of them, getting wind of the prince's character, had even come forward without any documents at all, and, would you believe it, the prince had satisfied almost all of them in spite of his friend's representations that all these wretches of creditors had absolutely no claim on him, and his only reason for satisfying them was that some of them actually had been unfairly treated. Madame Epanchin observed that old Bielokonski had written something of the sort to her, and that
it was stupid, very stupid. "There's no curing a fool," she added harshly.
But it could be seen from her face how pleased she was at the conduct of this fool. In the end, the general saw that his wife cared for Mushkin as though he were her son, and had begun to be unaccountably affectionate to Aglaya. Seeing this, Ivan Fyodorovitch assumed for a time a peculiarly business-like air. But this pleasant state of things did not last long. A fortnight passed, and again there was a sudden change. Madame Epanchin looked cross, and after some shrugging of the shoulders, General Epanchin resigned himself again to the ice of silence. The fact was that only a fortnight before he had privately received some brief and not quite clear, though authentic, information that Nastasia Philipovna, who had at first disappeared in Moscow, then been found there by Rogozhin, and had then again disappeared and been found again, had at last almost promised to marry him. And behold, only a fortnight later, His Excellency had suddenly learnt that Nastasia Philipovna had run away for the 3rd time, almost on her wedding day, and had disappeared somewhere in the provinces, and that Prince Mushkin had vanished at the same time, leaving all his business in Salazkin's charge.
Whether with her or simply in pursuit of her is not known, but there's something in it, the general concluded. Lizaveta Prokofievna, too, had received some unpleasant news. The upshot of it was that 2 months after the prince had gone, almost every rumour about him had died down in Petersburg, and the ice of silence was again unbroken in the Epanchin family. Varya, however, still visited the girls. To make an end of all these rumours and explanations, we will add that there were many changes in the Epanchin household in the spring, so that it was difficult not to forget the prince, who sent no news of himself, and perhaps did not care to do so. During the winter, they gradually came to the decision to spend the summer abroad. Lizaveta Prokofievna and her daughters, that is. It was, of course, impossible for the general to waste his time on frivolous diversion. This decision was due to the urgent and persistent efforts of the girls, who were thoroughly persuaded that their parents did not want to take them abroad, because they were so taken up with trying to marry them and find them husbands. Possibly the parents were convinced at last that husbands might be met with even abroad, and that travel for one summer, far from upsetting plans, might even perhaps be of use. This is the place to mention that the proposed marriage of Afanasy Ivanovich Totsky and the eldest of the girls had been broken off, and the formal offer of his hand had never been made. This had somehow happened of itself, without much talk and without any family quarrel. The project had suddenly been dropped on both sides at the time of Mushkin's departure. The circumstance had been one of the causes of the ill-humour prevailing in the Epanchin family, though the mother had declared at the time that she was so glad that she could have crossed herself with both hands at once. Although the general was in disfavour and knew that he was to blame, yet he felt aggrieved for a long time. He was sorry to lose Afanasy Ivanovich. Such a fortune, and such a sharp fellow. Not long afterwards, the general learnt that Totsky had been fascinated by a Frenchwoman of the highest society, a marquise and a legitimists, that they were going to be married, and that Afanasy Ivanovich was to be taken to Paris and then to Brittany. "Well, with the Frenchwoman he is lost to us," concluded the general.
The Epanchins were preparing to set off before summer, when suddenly a circumstance occurred which changed all their plans, and the tour was put off again, to the great delight of the general and his wife. A certain Prince S. came from Moscow to Petersburg, a well-known man, and well-known for his excellent qualities. He was one of those modern men, one may even say reformers, who are honest, modest, genuinely and intelligently desirous of the public weal, always working and distinguished by a rare and happy faculty of finding work. Not courting public notice, avoiding the bitterness and verbosity of party strife, the prince had a thorough understanding of contemporary movements, though he did not regard himself as a leader. He had been in the government service. Afterwards he had been an active member of a Zemstvo. He was, moreover, a correspondent of several learned societies. In collaboration with a well-known expert, he had collected facts and made inquiries which led to an improvement in the scheme for a very important new railway line. He was about 35. He was a man of the highest society, and had, moreover, a good, serious, and unmistakable fortune, in the words of General Epanchin, who happened to have to do with Princess about rather important business, and made his acquaintance in the house of the Count, who was the chief of General Epanchin's department. Princess had a certain interest in Russian practical men, and never avoided their society. It came to pass that the prince was introduced to the general's family. Adelaida Ivanovna, the second of the sisters, made a considerable impression upon him. Before the end of the winter he made her an offer. Adelaida liked him extremely. Lizaveta Prokofievna liked him too. General Epanchin was delighted. The foreign tour was, of course, put off. The wedding was fixed for the spring. The tour might still have come off in the middle of the summer, or towards the end of it, if only as a brief visit for a month or two to console the mother and the remaining daughters for the loss of Adelaida. But something fresh happened. Towards the end of the spring, Adelaida's wedding was deferred to the middle of the summer, Prince S. introduced to the Epanchins one of his own family, whom he knew very well, though he was only a distant relation.
This was Evgeny Pavlovich Radomsky, a young man of 28, an imperial aide-de-camp, extremely handsome and of good family. He was witty, brilliant, modern, of extreme education, and almost too fabulously wealthy. As to the latter point, General Apanchin was always very careful. He made inquiries.
Oh, there does seem to be something in it, though of course one ought to make sure.
This young and promising aide-de-camp was highly recommended by old Princess Bielokonski from Moscow. But one rumour about him was rather disturbing. There were tales of liaisons, of conquests and broken hearts. Seeing Aglaya, he became assiduous in his visits to the Apanchins. Nothing indeed had been said as yet, no hint even had been dropped, yet it seemed to the parents that it would be out of the question to go abroad that summer. Aglaya herself was of a different opinion. All this was happening just before our hero's second entry on the scene of our story. By that time, to judge by appearances, poor Prince Mushkin had been completely forgotten in Petersburg. If he had suddenly appeared now among those who had known him, he would seem to have fallen from heaven. We will add one other fact, and so complete our introduction. After Mushkin's departure, Kolya Ivolgin had at first spent his time as before. That is to say, he went to school, visited his friend, Ippolit, looked after his father, and helped Varya in the house and ran her errands. But the boarders were soon all gone. Ferdyshenko went away 3 days after the evening at Nastasia Filipovna's, and soon disappeared completely, so that nothing was known about him. It was said, though not on good authority, that he was drinking. Mushkin had gone away to Moscow, and there were no more boarders. Later on, when Varya was married, Nina Alexandrovna and Ganya moved with her to Titsin's house at the other end of Petersburg. As for General Ivolgin, a quite unforeseen event befell him about the same time. He was put in the debtors' prison. This was the doing of his friend, the captain's widow, on account of various bills he had given her to the value of 2,000 rubles. It was a complete surprise to him, and the poor general was undoubtedly the victim of his unfounded faith in the generosity of the human heart, speaking generally. Having adopted the soothing habit of signing promises to pay and IOUs, he had never conceived that they could ever lead to anything. He had always supposed that it was all right. It turned out not to be all right.
How can one put faith in mankind after that? How is one to show generous confidence?
He used to exclaim bitterly, sitting with his new friends in prison over a bottle of wine, and telling them anecdotes of the siege of Kars and the soldier who rose from the dead. It suited him capitally, however. Titsin and Varya maintained that it was the very place for him. Ganya quite agreed with them. Only poor Nina Alexandrovna shed bitter tears in secret, at which her household positively wondered, and, ill as she always was, she dragged herself as often as she could to visit her husband. But from the time of the general's mishap, as Kolya expressed it, and in fact from the time of his sister's marriage, Kolya had got quite out of hand, and things had come to such a pass that he rarely even slept at home. They heard that he had made a number of new acquaintances. Moreover, he became far too well known in the debtor's prison. Nina Alexandrovna could not get on there without him. At home, now, they did not even worry him with questions. Varya, who had been so severe with him before, did not pester him now with the slightest inquiry about his wanderings, and, to the surprise of the rest of the household, Ganya, in spite of his hypochondria, sometimes talked and behaved in quite a friendly way to him, and this was something quite new, for Ganya, at 27, had naturally never taken any friendly interest in his 15-year-old brother. He had treated him rudely, and had insisted on all the families being severe with him, and was always threatening to pull his ears, which drove Kolya beyond the utmost limits of human endurance. One might have imagined that Kolya had become positively indispensable to Ganya. He had been somewhat impressed by Ganya's returning that money. For that he was ready to forgive him a great deal. 3 months had passed since Mushkin's departure, when the Ivolgin family heard that Kolya had suddenly made the acquaintance of the Apanchins, and had been made very welcome by the young ladies. Varya soon heard of this, though it was not through her that Kolya came to know them, but of his own accord. The Epanchins gradually grew fond of him. Lizaveta Prokofievna did not take to him at all at first, but afterwards she began to make much of him, for his frankness and because he doesn't flatter. That Kolya did not flatter was perfectly true. He managed to be quite independent and on a perfectly equal footing with them, though he sometimes read books and papers to Madame Epanchin. But he was always ready to be of use. Once or twice, however, he quarrelled seriously with Lizaveta Prokofievna, and told her that she was a despot, and that he would not set foot again in her house. The first time the quarrel arose on the woman question, and the second time there was a difference of opinion as to the best time of the year for catching greenfinches. Strange as it may appear, 2 days after the quarrel, Madame Epanchin sent a note round to him by a footman, begging him to come. Kolya did not stand on his dignity, and went at once. Aglaya alone, for some reason, had no liking for him, and kept him at a distance. Yet it was Aglaya that he was destined to astonish. At Easter he seized an opportunity, when they were alone, and handed her a letter, saying nothing but that he was told to give it to her alone. Aglaya stared menacingly at the conceited little upstart, but Kolya went out without waiting further. She opened the letter and read.
"Once you honoured me with your confidence. Perhaps you have quite forgotten me now. How has it happened that I am writing to you? I don't know, but I felt an irresistible desire to remind you, just you, of my existence. How often I have wanted you all three, but of all three I saw only you. Need you. Need you very much. I have nothing to write to you about myself, have nothing to tell. That's not what I want to do. I have a great desire that you should be happy. Are you happy? That was all I wanted to say to you. Your brother, L. Mushkin."
Reading that brief and rather incoherent letter, Aglaya flushed all over and fell to musing. It would be hard to say what she was thinking of. Among other things, she asked herself whether she should show it to anyone. She felt somehow ashamed to. But she ended by throwing the letter into her table drawer with a strange and ironical smile. But the next day she took it out again, and put it into a thick, strongly bound book. She always did this with her papers, so that she might find them more readily when she wanted them. And not till a week after did she happen to notice what the book was. It was Don Quixote de la Mancha. Aglaya burst out laughing for some unknown reason. It is not known whether she showed the note to her sisters. But even while she was reading the letter, she wondered, can that conceited and boastful puppy be chosen as a correspondent by the prince, and perhaps his only correspondent here? With a show of exaggerated carelessness, she began to cross-examine Kolya. But though the boy was always quick to take offence, this time he did not in the least notice her carelessness. Very briefly and rather dryly he explained that, although he had given Mushkin his permanent address when the latter was leaving Petersburg, and had offered to do what he could for him, this was the first commission he had given him, and the first letter he had received from him. And in support of his words he showed her a letter addressed to him from Mushkin. Aglaya did not scruple to read it. The letter to Kolya ran as follows.
"Dear Kolya, will you be so good as to give the enclosed sealed letter to Aglaya Ivanovna? Hoping you are all well, your loving L. Mushkin." "It's ridiculous to trust a chit like you," Aglaya said huffily, handing Kolya back his letter, and she walked contemptuously by him. This was more than Kolya could endure, when he had even asked Ganya, without telling him why, to lend him his new green scarf for the occasion. He was bitterly offended.